Welcome to Bagless Africa, a podcast by Africans on building and innovating Web3 into a new frontier for the people of Africa. I'm your host, Miss Purple, and each episode, I get together with some wonderful people across the continent and the diaspora to talk, ideate, and dream about the bright future of our people. Stay tuned for another exciting episode. Hello and welcome to another episode of Bankless Africa. I am, of course, Miss Purple, and I am always super excited to be speaking with some phenomenal people who are creating great things and great innovations within this frontier space, but specifically focused to Africa. And I know I say this all the time, but I think I have some pretty cool people here today to share with us their work and their mission within the Web3 crypto space. How are you, Victor and Oyedeji?
Doing great. Thank you for having us.
Doing well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Now, of course, we're going to start off with our phenomenal tradition, which is you tell us some a story about yourself, you know, just a short summary of things you'd like us to know. Could be about your career or about, you know, essentially the road that led you here. But we would like to know who's Victor and who is Oyedeji? What are your, you know, what's your shtick? What's your thing?
Absolutely. I think perhaps if I go first, yeah. So I'm Victor Teixeira. I'm the guy on the team's crypto economist at Kansa Finance. So in terms of me and kind of my career, kind of my story, I really started in TradFi. That was really kind of where I went to after uni. I ended up at KPMG for a number of years, and really what I ended up doing there was working on some of the more complex financial models that you could do. So whether it was, you know, renewable energy and infrastructure type deals, where you have some of the more complex like PPP, public-private partnership type deals, M&A deals, and kind of all the rest of it and everything in between. And I really kind of found a passion for this whole idea that exists today in the traditional finance world, that a lot of these contracts are based around really the math that kind of builds up to these financial concepts. And so with regards to all that stuff, I really got into the detail there. And then in 2017, I met this gentleman that's on the call with me at a presentation in Australia and KPMG as well, where he was actually talking about what is Bitcoin. And this was really one of those early days type presentations. And just by happenstance, I was invited to this presentation by a mutual friend between Deji and I, and he introduced us together. And I think by the end of the night, Deji and I had spoken to absolutely nobody else. We were sitting in the corner of this pub in Sydney and just geeking out about what are the potentials that we could do for the African market with regards to crypto, and kind of how could we use Bitcoin at the time to settle all these complex derivatives. Then I kind of bounced off that for a little while, did a few other things, was kind of focused on other parts instead of focusing into crypto. And then in 2020, I get a call from Deji, and he essentially reaches out to me and says, "Hey, do you remember that chat we had in Sydney?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." And he said, "We need to have another one today." And so we end up catching up. And by the end of it, he's really opened up my eyes to the whole world of DeFi. And this was May of 2020. And so right at that point, I just went down the rabbit hole, locked myself in a room for like 4 days, was just reading through white papers. And by the time I emerged out on the other side, Deji got this 1,500-word email with like all the things I saw of opportunities in the space. And at that point, I knew I was hooked. And really, that's really kind of my story and how I kind of fell down the DeFi rabbit hole.
That's quite a story. I always love how it often starts with just a conversation between two people who perhaps find themselves in the same place at the same time, and then it kind of snowballs into something as great as this. What about for you, Oyedeji?
No, thank you. Yes, so my name is Oyedeji Lawoye. I guess my Web3 name is Crypto Honcho. I think I've been involved. I say I'm a techie, entrepreneur, innovator, different sports, and it's just to keep it, you know, full round. But when it comes to the tech and the position, how I got here, so quick about me, I was born and raised in Australia, which was really good because it really opened me up to multiple different nationalities from a very young age. Then moved to the US, to Alabama, for my higher education. Got into network engineering and Cisco, and very, very early, around 17 years old, passed my first CompTIA Network Plus test. And that's really got me down the engineering and the networking aspect, connecting people through IP, so Internet Protocol. So from there, moved into Atlanta, Georgia. Once I graduated college, I got accepted into AT&T's Network Leadership Program. That was very instrumental, really made me understand exactly the network from an enterprise level. And then, so since my parents are Nigerian, they got both PhDs. And then as well, my sister did a PhD as well. So they made sure that, at the minimum, I had to do my master's. So I started off at Georgia Tech, did a couple of classes there, software-defined networking and healthcare informatics. And then I really knew that maybe I really want to follow my father's path, who's a professor and researcher. So I really want to do a thesis and get into research. So from that aspect, transferred back to my old school to do it online. And then I did... research. At that same point, I was really focused on, personal finances, understanding in the US side, you have 401ks, and in Australia, you have supers, different type of those saving type of instruments. So, a person like me, I go down multiple rabbit holes, and I want to understand finance from scratch. So via that, I ended up finding out about Bitcoin from YouTube redirection to understanding money and then the internet and network engineering. So that was the focus of the thesis. It's called the Bitcoin, the network analysis of the infrastructure. And I did that in fall 2015, and then I defended that in spring 2016. So I've been down the rabbit hole ever since. It's created multiple great opportunities. Started off with doing outreach activities to African-American students with Zcash. So talking to them about privacy concepts and then cryptocurrency. At the same time, it was really the ICOs and things of that nature coming along. So we really got to understand face-to-face when you talk to random people, what did they think about cryptocurrency and then blockchain infrastructure and technology. So from there, that led me to doing one more major thing in corporate America, which won a social impact award for blockchain as a service. That was via my AT&T company. And that won the social impact award across all the VPs, DirecTV, the cable infrastructure, Warner, Time Warner, and different things of that nature. So that was a really good confidence. I did that with my then, I say now, co-founder, which is Pascal Natsama, who was also part of the network engineering program at AT&T as well. So once we did that, we understood that, okay, if we could do this at an enterprise level, because they moved into AT&T Labs, how do we bring this technology to, help and assist with emerging markets in the continent of Africa? So started really just getting into the coding. I think the outreach really gave us a really good feel of what end users are thinking. But once you get into the code, it was really like, okay, how do we create this technology to really impact? So took out mobile phone numbers, created a lot of different Python scripts to get to different prices, and then combined that into the local currencies, Nigerian Naira, South African Rand, etc. And then really just started there, and then got into a consensus mesh accelerator, which was backed by Tachyon, and then also Filecoin when it comes to data. And then did a... never accelerated with Stellar and the Stellar ecosystem pertaining to that telco background and mobile phone. So that was a very, very big intro, but I think that gives a good context to my background.
Yes, I think it was a very necessary intro, especially because I think there's always a rabbit hole. I think somewhere or another, we always end up in a rabbit hole and we find ourselves not being able to comprehend what it would be like to not understand what we do understand. But I'd like to start with you, Oyedeji, to ask, how would you describe your role at Kanzer outside of the title itself? How would you describe what it is exactly that you do there?
No, that's great. That's a great question. To be very honest, from an entrepreneur aspect and everybody listening that's on the tech or trying to create solutions, you're wearing multiple hats. Myself as well, I'm not the biggest guy into titles. When I get onto different phone calls or pitches, I'll just say I'm just a co-founder. But I do have different knowledge into the technology just from the last 8 years, as well as the network and engineering background. But no, it's really multiple hats. like I said, my traditional, I'd say technical acronym was more of network engineering communications. And then once, you know, with the background of IP, you could really just overlay that into connecting. So, it dives into learning different financial aspects from the Western side of the world, as well as emerging markets, really understanding and communicating across the board and the team to really understand how do we build products that are actually solving real world solutions and actually going to create real value. So it's multiple hats. Probably got like five or six different applications across Slack, WhatsApp, Telegram, etc. That really helps to assist. But it's really, yeah, it's all of it within the whole tech and the Web3 part. So I don't know if there's a one clear definition of the role, but really designing, understanding the background. How do we facilitate the products that we're developing to create real impact for the end users? But then really understanding the user behaviors as well. So it's multiple hats also.
And what about for you, Victor? Is it the same situation where one finds themselves doing all the work or every single thing that needs to be done if you're available to do it?
Yeah, I think really it's kind of the situation of how you have to handle it with regards to kind of crypto. And I also, to be honest, I think even broader, you get a little philosophical about it. It's just life. I think I've always kind of had this attitude drilled into me from a young age, which is really just next man up, or, you know, whatever happens, you know, somebody might not be there one day and something still needs to get done when you're working. So, and if you don't do it, somebody else is going to have to do that for you. So it just comes down to a situation where you just have to be able to just always be quite dynamic and quite agile and kind of fit in into different gaps. I think from my standpoint, I probably shock our engineers more often than not with when I'm just like, send me the code, I'll review it. And then I find the bug in the code with them and those kind of things. And they wouldn't necessarily expect that from a finance guy. But it's just one of those things where whether it be marketing, investor outreach, you know, even coding or anything, it just everybody needs to just be able to be willing to kind of step into that role and do that job. And really, especially in the startup world, the biggest difference between this and what I'd say is like a corporate role or traditional finance role is that there isn't really that safety net where, you know, if you truly make a big mistake on a financial model, you'll have your director or your managing director that can look at it. And then if they miss it, then there's the model auditor that also picks it up. And so in that sense, you always kind of have this ability to kind of really stick to your lane in a corporate role versus in a startup role. The whole idea is that it's very fluid. So, you know, there's really no lanes. It's really just, it's almost like a figure eight traffic circle where you've got to just kind of find your way through it, navigate all the solutions and kind of just figure out where the opportunities are and really just learn and do whatever you have to do to really make things work. And so I think that's why it's super exciting and super fun when compared to what would be more of a traditional corporate role, in my opinion.
Absolutely. I think the flexibility is what also makes everything stand out in a positive manner, hopefully. But what exactly is Kanza?
Great question. So what we are as Kanza is we are a Web3 focused company that is building the world's largest non-institutional based financial system. So what that means is really what we're trying to do is we're really trying to build the bridges between TradFi and DeFi to really build this new innovative solution specifically for the African market to provide businesses with the financial services that they deserve. A big focus with regards to the African market, and as I'm sure we all see it in the space, is that there's always a big focus on the unbanked population, which is absolutely an important portion of the population. But from our standpoint, we also see that there's a massive really lack of the underserved. Nobody's really going for the underserved population in the space. And so with regards to Kanza, our goal is really to build the financial solutions and primitives that are required to really help those businesses take it to the next level. And so I always kind of like using this this kind of metric as an example, and I think it's a really good one. Africa accounts for about 60% of the world's total arable land. The United States accounts for only about 10%. But the U.S. market accounts for over about 75% of the total agricultural derivatives on Earth. Africa is a fraction of a percent of the total derivatives traded in that space. So we really just see that there is just this massive difference between what's available to businesses in Western countries and in more prosperous regions of the world versus what's actually available to businesses in Africa. And that really doesn't make any sense when, at the end of the day, all those businesses are as much, if not more so, impacted by macro changes in the global landscape and global price movements. And so therefore, really, our goal is really to build that, not only that front-end traditional finance interface to facilitate payments and cross-border transactions, but really to build that second layer of additional offerings and products in which businesses can really benefit and either hedge or benefit from broader macro trends that occur through our Bakkt Infinite Liquidity Stablecoin solution or through our fixed income products as well as our other innovations that we're currently working on.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I think putting more perspective or information towards the vision and mission, I think we understand about the global markets. We have a lot of different like technical acronym across multiple different factors, but I think we're really on the pathway to, you know, how I would say this, remove the term from emerging markets. So when it comes down to the narrative of emerging markets, we talk about Africa, but which I truly believe from my side is that blockchain, Web3, and then that mix between that TradFi, DeFi can really remove that term. So it's just now, okay, African market, it's no longer going to be emerging. And I think that's the power of what the internet also brings along as well. And that's really what we're striving towards, right? Bringing the full value of the continent of Africa, you know, as its own respected market.
I'm actually curious to know, is there perhaps a definition that defines when do you stop being emerging and when are you an actual flourishing market? Is there something that says that, or does that just simply depend on the global powers that be?
I'm sure there's probably an economics definition in academia that probably is put in certain boundaries around that. But I think at the same time, we still see countries like Brazil, India, and China as emerging markets. But I think if we compare them where they are today to where they were in the early 90s, they are leaps and bounds ahead of where they were. And so I think that is a good question, because it becomes how do you actually define success? And what is, I guess, what is sufficient success for you to kind of drop that type of argument? But I think the broader point here is really around the lines of what is tangibly seen in the difference between those. I think that would really be the kind of the core part for us, is that how do we actually create a tangible outcome that really provides that step change and that feeling in terms of the step change there.
So cross-border settlements and treasury management are both tentatively very fragile arenas for anybody to try to tackle. So how is Kanza able to commit itself to being resilient in the face of perhaps, say, a global crisis of any sort? What are you doing to ensure that you can continue providing all your services regardless of what happens? Because I think that's also the other thing. You know, sometimes people will promise people certain services, but the minute something goes off, they are incapable of being able to live up to that. How are you able to commit to doing something like that?
That's a great question. That's really, really good. So I think in terms of really there's a term I really, really like that was rather popular a few years ago, which is anti-fragile. And one of the big things with regards to anti-fragility is how do you build things that are robust in the structure long-term? And one of the beauties about the DeFi ecosystem is that everything has to be built around a trustless base. And especially in terms of a lot of the aspects of payments and such, a lot of what we see today really works along the lines still of somewhat requiring trust, whether that be through a centralized exchange, whether that be through a counterparty and through other elements. But DeFi really stands out in contrast to that, with just this kind of like broader attitude, and crypto as an ecosystem, with this attitude of, no, we don't need trust. We need to build things where we're trading capital efficiency to remove counterparty risk. And that's really what you see in a lot of these DeFi protocols, where they're much less capitally efficient than what you'd get in a traditional financial system, but they are much more resilient to shocks in the system because there's these algorithmic kind of handrails that you always sit within, and the smart contract will always act in the way that it's most of the time in the way that it's supposed to. But I think in terms of how we approach this is that we really always kind of think, what's the worst case scenario? Where can we really have a single attack vector to get us? And then the way that we always think about it is that if there is a way to shut down DeFi or a way to stop us, then we're not doing DeFi correctly, because that means that there was a single attack vector or single point of failure that could be targeted to really hit us. And so in that sense, everything we do is always built around the structures of how do we build this in a trustless way? How do we make this focused on minimizing counterparty risks? So how do we, we might have to over-collateralize certain transactions. We might have to, make transactions on a peer-to-peer level. But then that really reduces that risk that there is this additional gateway that can really give us a shock to kind of stop how the system works. And so that's really kind of the core philosophy that we have with regards to building all of our products.
I mean, that sounds like a brilliant answer if I've ever heard any. So just to clarify for our listener, Kanza raised $3.27 million for its international payment service. Now, my question is, it's been almost a year since the raising of those funds. What have been your biggest elements of focus in this past year in terms of rolling out those funds and, of course, moving towards progress, especially given the climate that we've been in the past year, which has not been ideal at all?
Yeah, that's great. That's a great question. I think we're in the internet space and run an internet business. That's one layer. But then when you dive now into the Web3 aspect, you're really diving into multiple different challenges, smart contracts, and different engineering. So even with the international payment, you see now that you can utilize Web3 to fill in those different holes or gaps pertaining to fragmentation or liquidity. Like I mentioned earlier, I come from a really big research background myself, as well as my co-founder, and we really love to understand, the local layout. Really love to understand the ins and outs of all moving parts to then provide the right products to facilitate. I think we don't have this copy and paste type of mentality just because there's code out there, even though we're in open source, but we really try to create things from the ground up to really help facilitate. So majority of the work has been into real in-depth research, creating the right MVPs and proof of concepts to validate the different processes that we see within each vertical, but then also utilize the different resources and networks from the from that raise and the different VCs in the background to really expand the network and understand the Web3 part to really connect everything globally. So it's been a very insightful year. We've seen multiple different things happen. A lot of my friends or crypto OGs or whales or different things of that nature really discuss about, everything in crypto. It's like, 2 weeks in crypto could be like 4 or 5 years, right? So, what happens with traditional markets now? We understand that we're in basically a high risk asset class. So when we understand that when economy does go down, majority of people usually do pull out their high risk asset investments. But then now it gives us the challenge of how do you create a robust business, that is, I guess, within the trade in terms of things like delta neutral. So whatever happens, regardless, that you're still in a position to profit and make money. So last year, to be very honest, it was very up and down. But I think going back to the entrepreneurship mindset, as well as just having that ability to see things maybe before they even happen, it really just fortifies that, because experience is the best teacher, but it's in what you do once you understand that fully, completely. So I think I go back to that. I think that Rocky movie, it's not how hard you get hit. It's the ability to keep coming back, you know, and get hit much more. So I think that's really makes it another aspect of like iron sharpens iron, and then utilizing all the different resources and tools available within the Web3 space, as well as the TradFi aspects to really hit it home. So it's going to be exciting 2023, and I think we've got the right tools and moving parts to really address these different problems.
You know, TradFi has not exactly been very welcoming of DeFi, and whether or not one has found, you know, kind of like a workaround, I'm assuming that there's still a lot more negativity and a lot more backlash that you're facing. How are you guys able to perhaps navigate not just, you know, the negative feedback from other TradFi companies, but what about the more regulatory aspect of things? How are you able to make sure that you stay in line and nobody ever has any space at any point in time to negate what it is that you are doing for the people?
That's a brilliant question. That's really brilliant. I think from my standpoint, having come from TradFi, I mean, the amount of snickers and kind of comments I know that have been going on with regards to me moving across to crypto from the TradFi side, I think more than most, I probably understand that there is a massive reticence from the TradFi environment with regards to DeFi. But fundamentally, and I think this is really comes down to an education piece, is that the biggest challenge we have in crypto today is how do we disassociate from really the early days of crypto in terms of just Bitcoin and Ethereum? How do we kind of show that we have evolved as a space in the last 3 years, more than what I'd say the financial services industry, especially the derivatives market industry, has evolved in the last 10 years or even 20 years in traditional finance. So the biggest part here, I think, is an education piece where fundamentally the core tenet of DeFi is that we do not need to rely on the ideals and beliefs of traditional finance, which require this idea of a regulated, trustworthy counterparty. In DeFi, we trade that regulated, trustworthy counterparty for a smart contract, where in a lot of the processes that occur in TradFi are along the lines of if this, then that type contracts, whether it be in a financial model or whether it be in a financial contract itself, or even in some of the algorithmic trading approaches that exist in TradFi for hedge funds. The vast majority of this is if this, then that type logic. And that lends itself incredibly well to actually work within a smart contract structure. Now, the biggest difference, I think, between the two, and arguably a point where TradFi can always say that they have an advantage to an extent, is with regards to capital efficiency. And in the sense that DeFi essentially trades that away for lower counterparty risk, because you don't actually need to trust the counterparty that you have. And often I find that when we actually go through the processes and start explaining the individual transactions, the individual steps, and the logic and the game theory that sits behind a lot of these structures, the TradFi guys start kind of looking at it with wider and wider eyes and start kind of getting more fascinated by the actual entity. Because at the end of the day, what is a financial contract? It's just an agreement in the TradFi world. What's a share? There's no physical, tangible asset to that anymore. It doesn't exist in that way. It exists only really as this kind of ephemeral item that exists out there that represents something, but doesn't actually allow you to do anything except for what the broader system allows you to do. Versus in DeFi, there is a less, it not be tangible physically, but there is a digital record of your interaction with that contract or your position. There's a physical record to that, which sits in a uncontrolled system, which is permissionless. And really, that's the difference from trying to get them to understand. And that's what I've seen from my experience is really kind of the moment, the aha moment that they have when they realize, ooh, actually there's something interesting here. Oh, I can enter into a swap contract with somebody and it's in a trustless environment. And then you start looking at all the other options. And then if you want to take on more risk, you can actually take on a bit more capital efficiency for more risk. And there are these trade-offs there. So I think from the TradFi environment standpoint, it's really just trying to get them to move away from thinking all blockchain and all crypto is just Bitcoin and Ethereum. And it's this whole like, oh, Bitcoin goes up, Dogecoin, you know, like they don't, that's a part that they are still working on kind of separating themselves from. Now, from a regulatory standpoint, I think this is very interesting as well, because one of the really interesting things, and recently I was at a regulators policy forum here in London hosted by Warwick Business School, where we had a number of central bankers from the Central Bank of Canada, the Fed, BIS as well. The really interesting thing with regards to how they see the regulatory framework and kind of how it has to be built around is that they still have a tendency to say, oh, well, we need these old systems and the old laws. But the thing is, a lot of these old laws are there to actually cover up for the fact that there is a massive asymmetry of information between the regulator and a company operating in the environment. So, for example, if we look at the 2008 mortgage crisis, AIG, American Insurance Group, what they were able to do was that they ended up selling more insurance than what they actually had collateral for instruments that were highly risky and were likely to default. Because they were highly risky and likely to default, they had really high premiums associated with them, which made the banks, the insurance group, a lot of money in terms of the premiums. And therefore, they were incentivized to sell more than what they could actually cover. All these assets were correlated. As we know what happened there, it essentially gets to a position where they have a massive liability that they can't cover. And now the issue is the regulator says, oh, how did we let this happen? Well, you never actually had oversight over it. You only had the oversight of what they told you and chose to tell you maybe once a year in an annual report or through quarterly reports. There wasn't a running long-term standing availability to see that. Now, when the cryptos, when the regulators come to crypto, the interesting thing for them is that now a lot of the structures and the ideas that exist in, say, MiFID II and all those other types of regulation in Europe, is they're just there because you can't see the data. But now in crypto, you can see everything at any point in time. As long as you're able to really associate, figure out where the liabilities in the system are, where the leverage is, from a regulator standpoint, they can really actually see that and be much more comfortable with the approach of how it works. And I think lastly, just to kind of, you know, like cap this all off, I think the most important part from a regulatory standpoint will also be the education around smart contracts and really getting them to understand it and feel comfortable with the idea that a smart contract is just as powerful, if not more, and I'd personally argue significantly more powerful than any legal restrictions you put. Because a legal restriction is just a legal restriction that you are now have a liability if you break that legal restriction. In a smart contract, the law that you put in that smart contract through the code, there is no way you can go against it. And so therefore, that determines really what that smart contract will do and how it will do it, which I think from a regulator standpoint should be incredibly attractive because it fundamentally removes a lot of the agency and opportunity for bad actors to step in and make these kind of bad decisions that would punish the funded, the really the last mile user that really touches this. So that's kind of my view on that question.
I appreciate the extensiveness of it because, you know, sometimes it's our tendency to want to split things and separate one from the other, missing the fact that everything kind of tends to bleed into each other and the one thing, you know, one begets the other. So thank you very much for sharing on that. Can you talk us through your main product offerings and which countries they're currently available in as Kanza?
Yeah, Vic. I like to take the aspect on the DeFi and Barkey, but yeah, from our side now, we do the OTC aspects, as well as like what you mentioned within that raise, the cross border settlements are powered by, you know, Web3 technology as well as stable coins, and then utilizing those different ecosystems such as Celo, Cardano, Filecoin to assist with that. As well as we have multiple other different R&D products in the background, but since it comes out to what's happening live right now, it's really the OTC aspects and technology to assist the continent of Africa, and then as well as the different products that Vic will dive into pertaining to the DeFi, and then how do we see that fixing or solving different problems from SME side.
Yeah, so with regards to the DeFi side, our main product right now that we're working on, that's really our flagship product, is called Baki. Baki is a infinite liquidity stablecoin FX protocol that will allow users to mint African currencies on chain. in a fully decentralized exchange with infinite liquidity and no slippage when you move between currencies. So the way it works is that you can deposit your stablecoins. Once you deposit your stablecoins, you're able to mint what we call Zed tokens against that. And those Zed tokens can be denominated in one of four currencies. US dollars, South African rand, Nigerian naira, and CIFA. And the beauty about these Zed tokens, so Zed naira, Zed USD, Zed CIFA, is that when you hold one Zed token, you will always have guaranteed liquidity to another Zed token. And so the way that this works is because a user deposits his collateral and that collateral is used to cover the entire pool of the outstanding tokens, that means that the protocol is completely agnostic whether that debt balance is denominated 100% US dollars or 100% CIFA or 100% Naira or any combination thereof, which means when you want to move from one currency to another, all you have to do is burn that currency and mint the equivalent value in the other currency. Now, the real beauty about this is that this really works very well if we're looking at it from a standpoint of a working capital currency for African businesses, where they now do not have to worry about whether or not there's liquidity on the other side of their transaction when they make a cross-border trade, whether they're able to recycle that trade and bring the capital back into the original country, or whether they actually just want to access US dollars temporarily to hedge against any volatility in the currency. All of that can actually be done through the system. And really the idea here is that this solves a lot of the issues that we're seeing today, which is with regards to the dollar shortages that we're seeing across the entire continent, which is purely driven by the fact that people do not want to hold currencies that may have volatility associated with them. And so therefore, they're rushing to acquire fiat US dollars. And because the fiat US dollars have a finite amount of them available in the system, that means that you'll end up in situations with like what we're seeing in Nigeria today, where there's a significant premium to the US dollars through the parallel market versus what's available on the official market at the central bank rate. And so therefore, the solution to this is really synthetic assets. And it always has been. I mean, this was very much the case in the early 20th century when commodity broking started growing rather quickly in the United States. People didn't want to physically settle the assets and actually own the they didn't want to physically own the milk or the coal or the wheat that they were purchasing. They started creating the idea of synthetic assets that just track the price and really offer a secondary market that actually is associated with the primary market, but is in of itself its own market. So that's really our core product that we're going with. And really the idea here is to use this really as the backbone to build a much more advanced financial system for the entire continent. And so once you have this layer of you actually have the currencies on chain, now the opportunities with regards to developing your options, forwards, swaps, and other derivatives that allow people to hedge or benefit from broader macro trends or limit currency risk really are endless. And this is something that we encourage not only our team to build on top and come up with ideas, but we're really excited to kind of put this out into the broader space and see who else is actually able to build in and build on top of us and build these kind of really new and exciting products using these stable coin currencies really as the foundation of this broader financial system.
I found somewhere online that you were defined as a crypto neobank. Now, for reference purposes, a neobank, according to Razorpay, is defined as a new age bank without any physical location present entirely online. They provide digital mobile-first financial solutions for payments, money transfers, lending, and more. Now, being a crypto neobank, are your services able to actually reach people who perhaps don't have access to smart devices or the internet or perhaps constant electricity? Because most of the time, so those are the people who tend to have issues or need access to your services or your tools. So how are they able to access them if they don't really have that? Or are you perhaps navigating that in a more, you know, slower manner of starting off with those who are more in denser towns and then hoping that eventually the lessons will reach those who are outside of those areas?
Yeah, that's a good definition. So I think I personally mentioned, we do a lot of different research, right? So the part that we really wanted to dive in the beginning, we created different tools around the telco innovation. So when we think about 2G and we think about different tools like SMS as well, we created basically pricing aspects that go to USSD, by just dialing, you know, one of those short codes. So that was really to understand exactly, get into the end users that are in, you know, rural areas or remote parts, by utilizing telco technology and then building tools around that. So that's how we've seen it when we look at like the whole spectrum. But then we also created other different tools that was assisting different B2Bs and enterprises. So we love the concept of that. I think the tools that products that we've made are within that financial realm, but then it's looking at more of like a Web3. You know, what does a Web3 bank mean? I think the beauty of the Web3 aspect is that, you know, we are designing this as we go along, and then we're utilizing the, you know, the open source software to help assist. But I think from the MVPs and proof of concepts that we've built, we've had a massive focus on the retail and end users in remote areas, but then also a massive focus on B2B and enterprise.
And I think if I could perhaps add to that, I think one of the kind of issues that we have is when we think of banks, we often very much think of just the really a retail or commercial bank. But really the kind of aspect that we see that there's a massive gap in the African market is with regards to the idea of an investment bank. The banks that are able to provide you those kind of next level derivative products to really protect your business and help businesses kind of grow and finance and do all those things. So in terms of that aspect, that's also a region where we're kind of willing to spread out into, and that's really been a lot of our focus for our products, is really focusing not only on the individual who doesn't necessarily have access to stable internet or stable power or access to that, but also the business that actually doesn't have access to those types of infrastructures, or doesn't even have access to the right connections or the right people to actually get these kind of more advanced type offerings within them. So that's really been one of our focuses for how we see really the growth, is that if we're able to really build that business base and kind of come in and kind of act similar to how an investment bank works, you know, with markets. And I think fantastic examples, and I always talk about history because I think crypto is really that type of reset in our whole financial system. But if we look at a lot of what happened in the 19th century in terms of when the big banks like JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs came about, really what they were doing is that they were supporting local and small and medium-sized businesses across the United States to become really these multinationals that we see today, whether it be Standard Oil with John D. Rockefeller or Bell Telephone Company. All of those had the support of these banks really early on, and both of them grew hand in hand. And so that's very similar to kind of the approach that we're trying to do here, which is really find these really quality, strong, resilient businesses locally that we can then work our way and build upwards from there.
As we bring this show to a close, I'd like to end off with asking one final question. What would you say are your biggest wants out of the space, specifically for Africa and other emerging markets? What are the things or the elements that you would like to see coming into play within the next, I guess, few years?
Yeah, I think perhaps I'll go first here on my side. I think what I'm really, really excited for is really what I've seen already from regulators and governments in the space, is that there is an openness to have the conversation. And one of my biggest wants is for that openness and that willingness to have these conversations continues. I think the most important part here is that on both sides, from a regulator standpoint and also from a project standpoint, we need to educate each other. And we really need to keep those conversations going and really work on these building blocks to build these foundations so that we can all prosper together in the space. And I think that's kind of my biggest want there. I think the other aspect of it is that I think this is from a broader aspect. And I think this is something I witnessed when we were at Token 2049. I personally just really want the broader crypto ecosystem to just pay a bit more attention to Africa. I think one of the interesting things that I witnessed was it was a fantastic panel with the number of VCs, leading VCs across the space from all the big firms. And when they really talked about the opportunity of crypto, they mentioned Southeast Asia, they mentioned Latin America. Central America, and then just every time they just never said Africa. And so from a personal standpoint, I just really kind of want that attention to start looking at what we're building in the space, because not only are we building really cool things, there are other teams that are building really, really amazing things. But then the really even more exciting part is that the grassroots movements of the developers and the engineers and everything is really starting to, this massive groundswell of that we're noticing more and more. And the really cool thing is, especially with regards to Africa, is the diversity that it has in terms of the languages and the cultures across the board really mean that, for example, the French market or the Brazilian market, which is kind of secondary crypto and DeFi markets today, will actually have the opportunity to actually have developers coming out of Cameroon, Togo, Cote d'Ivoire, or Angola and Mozambique to actually help those regions locally. And so, funnily enough, one of our partners that we have in Brazil, their CTO is actually from Cabo Verde in Africa. And so it's a bit this really interesting thing where we're starting to slowly see this kind of Africa exporting these engineers across the world. And really what I kind of really wish is that we'd get a bit more attention so that we could really harness this excitement and really take this to the next level, because there's so much opportunity to be brought to the broader ecosystem, not just for the continent of Africa, but for the whole world.
No, that's great, Vic. I think from my side, I think Vic touched upon it. I think just the understanding of the respect from the African point of view. When we go back to, you know, the original Bitcoin white paper and some original projects that are still seeing volume and traction now, it's just that to unlock the true value of this whole Web3 space and blockchain space, to put Africa in the position where we can utilize the internet to basically get it on the same level playing field globally. I think there's so many really cool, interesting projects and really cool developers on the continent. But I guess my major ask is just to really take the Web3 concepts to build products for that localized infrastructure, right? It's not like just coming from the West and just copying and pasting or putting a square into a circle. It's really understanding the local layout and build products, you know, to really assist your communities and your people on the ground. So I think that's really where I really want, and I think that's the mission that we drive to within Kansas Finance. So yeah, it's going to be exciting our next couple of years, but all the data and the numbers, you know, a lot of people are paying attention, but now I guess we just got to show them.
Correct. Now it's just a question of delivering and actually living up to your word. Now, thank you so much for coming onto the show. Usually at the end, we play a little game where I ask you for three words about how you currently feel about where the space is at this current moment. So it can be just three individual words or three phrases or perhaps a sentence that has three words. Anything you feel that best describes how you feel about the space.
Okay, I guess I'll dive into my three. Probably a lot of the audience are familiar with. I'll just say build, hold, and then innovate.
Mine might be one more word than three, but we gonna be all right.
Hey, I like both sets of those words, I think. But I think, Oyedeji, you said the other one wrong. I think it's supposed to be huddle. Perhaps they didn't understand if you just said hold, but I like them both. I like them both. We're going to be all right because, you know, it's rough. It's rough, but we'll be all right at the end of the day. Now, thank you again to you both for coming onto the show and shedding light on your work in Cancer and, of course, as the space as a whole. That was Victor, who serves on paper as the lead crypto economist, and Oyedeji, who is the co-founder and CTO of Cancer. Now, remember, to you who are listening, there is a whole world yet to be discovered, and this time, Africa is at the core of the table. Thank you for spending another episode with me. Just a reminder that none of what we share is financial advice, only opinions of the individuals that make this show possible. You can use the links in the show notes to do your own research. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and give us a rating on whatever platform you're listening from. We are our own wildest dreams, the hope of our own tomorrow. So until next time, keep innovating.